TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg. Okay, go! Your official home of the Winnipeg Jets, a division of Bell Media. TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of in-depth analysis, insight, and opinion into Canada's game. And now, here's Drew, Richard, and Ezra.
Filling in the host seat for Drew Mandel, I'm Richard Pollock, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg. Michael Remus is on this side of the glass this week. And of course, producer Tim Debenham. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, live Saturday, April 14th. Boys, playoffs have started since the last show, and it's actually been an amazing start to the playoffs so far. Ezzy?
It's been absolutely unbelievable. What more can you ask for? Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, 13 goals yesterday. You know, before we get started, Richie, I got to say, it's weird. I'm sitting over here in your seat.
Mm-hmm.
You're sitting in Drew's seat.
Drew? Who's Drew?
Remus is sitting to your right, kind of. We have a circular kind of table here. Timmy's in his usual spot as well. Drew's in Kentucky, yet he's tweeting and calling us every 15 minutes and letting us know, apparently now Daniel Sedin's out for the first round. We're going to get into that later. But yeah, you know, it's going to be fun because round one, it's always the best. Round one is the best. I think the Stanley Cup playoffs are the best time of year, you know, period. Mm-hmm. But the first round is always the best, and it hasn't disappointed at all so far.
They say it's the best hockey because you have, obviously, every team's involved, but most importantly because you have the best teams involved and they're fresh.
Yep.
Because some of these teams really do coast through the regular season, and they're fresh now, and you have a Pittsburgh-Philly team. This would be an amazing series in the conference finals, if not maybe the Stanley Cup finals eventually with a change of format. But the best matchup between the two teams is in the first round because they're fresh, ready to go, and healthy.
You know, guys, the one thing I love about the first round is just how many games are on. You know, it seems like every night there's four games on. I love the late games, the early games. Every game's being broadcast now. You just can't get enough hockey.
You can't. And you know, we're going to preview tonight's games a little later on. I want to review last night's games, so first. Before we do review last night's games, I want to talk about the guests we're going to have on tonight. This afternoon, excuse me.
Lots of guests today.
Lots of guests. We got four guests. Well, there's a lot of series going on right now. We have Mike Colligan. He's going to talk about the Pittsburgh-Philly series from the Pittsburgh perspective. He writes for thehockeywriters.com as well as Forbes Money. He is a very informative writer. He is able to explain the strategies of teams as well as anybody I've seen in a while. It's similar, actually, to the way Al Strachan used to do it when he was writing at the Toronto Sun and other places. After that, we have Ben Kuzma of the Vancouver Province is going to be on a little bit later. Now, I say that because Daniel Sedin, just breaking, as Ezra just mentioned, is out for the series. So we already have to change our questions for Ben Kuzma. He's going to be on later on in the show. Sam Carcitti is going to be on later on in the show.
Excellent Philly writer.
Yes, and Sam is from the Philadelphia Inquirer. We actually had the opportunity to meet him earlier this year, and he is covering the most intense series. And so if you notice, there's eight series obviously going on. We're going to get the Pittsburgh perspective from Mike in the first hour. We're going to get the Philly perspective from Sam in the third hour. We're going to speak to Ben Kuzma of the Province in the second hour. And also, closing out the first hour, Josh Cooper of the Tennessean. Nashville-Detroit, that might be the second best series. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to argue that Philadelphia-Pittsburgh is the best series, but Nashville-Detroit is probably, you could argue, the second best series. Josh is going to talk about that series. There's been a number of things that have happened that we're going to talk about, including the Shea Weber head smash, the WWE-style head smash, the fact the series is obviously 1-1. We'll get into a bunch of other things there. But last night, we all watched the game, Pittsburgh-Philly. Once again, Pittsburgh gets out to a lead.
15 seconds into the game.
Yes, and a 14
goal, seconds.
And a two-goal lead. And once again, they blow it. I mean, guys, what's going on?
Here, I'll go ahead and fear first. You know, I think you got to give credit to Coach Peter Laviolette, you know, recognizing at the beginning his team is down, they're in a bit of a rut, calling a timeout. I don't know what he says in these timeouts, but whatever he's doing, it's getting the team regrouped and ready to come back.
Yep. And you know, on that point, Ez, quickly, on that point, one thing about Philly is, and we actually, when we were out with some of the Philly writers earlier this year, I said to Sam, I thought they were the best passing team in the National Hockey League. I didn't think anybody moved the puck better than them, any other team. And they don't seem intimidated, first off, by the Penguins in general, but they don't seem intimidated by deficits. And so many teams in this league are coached to play a defensive style.
Right.
And are once they get down, they have to change what they're doing. Philly's an offensive team. They don't really have to change what they're doing when they get down because they're always aggressive. And I think that's worked in their favor.
I think there's a couple of things about this game, and I do agree with Reem. I think Peter Laviolette has shown that, you know, they go down a couple goals. This team knows that they can score goals in bunches, and we were talking about this. Arguably, Philly has the best depth of any team.
Yeah, I got to say something about that. Yeah. You know, you were reading pre-playoffs that the best forward group by some people, top to bottom, was St. Louis. That's a stretch, and let's be real here. There's nobody in the NHL. We can talk about other teams, too. But there's nobody in the NHL who would take St. Louis's 12 forwards over Philly's.
You know, the thing about St. Louis is they have a lot of solid forwards. That's they don't have the high-end talent that Philly has. And I think one of the things that's been apparent with Philly, you know, from watching the 24/7 and from talking to the Philly beat writers is this group is a cohesive unit. They all get along. They seem to all generally like each other. They're all happy for each other. And I think that's something that shouldn't go overlooked on a championship team.
And they're a playoff, you know, it's hard to, you can't really quantify this. They're a playoff-looking team. The way they play, the way they carry themselves, and the guys they have on their roster. You know, you have the Scotty Hartnell kind of player.
He hasn't even got going so far.
I know. You have Scotty Hartnell. Yep. Obviously, Claude Giroux has become a top 10 player in the National Hockey League. But
I would say top three.
You could argue that. You could honestly argue that. But there's other players, you know, on this team. Voracek, you have obviously Jagr, but you have guys who are ready to go. They know what it takes. These skill set of the Flyers complement each other so well. And from the Pittsburgh perspective at this point in time, you have to be legitimately concerned about your defense. Paul Martin has looked horrid. Ben Lovejoy looked poor last night.
He coughed up the puck to Couturier on his first goal.
Yeah, they missed, and he blew a coverage on the Jagr goal, the winning goal, which is the sixth goal of the game last night.
That's right.
Lovejoy, I mean, England's nothing to write home about. I mean, are you really, and Letang has shortcomings defensively. Are you really banking on, I mean, has it come down, we talked about this last week, has it come down to the fact that now you only really have Orpik and Mihailuk to depend on defensively? And Michael, you pointed this out last night. No Hallegill. Like from a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And obviously, no Scuderi. Now, Scuderi, you know, they wanted to replace those two guys, essentially with these two guys. I never liked Paul Martin in the first place, but there is an element that they are lacking right now.
You know, you watch the King series, and you can see what Rob Scuderi brings.
Yes, you can.
You know, the one image I remember with Rob Scuderi in the Stanley Cup Finals is him saving that goal, you know, sliding across the goal line. And if you YouTube Rob Scuderi, you know, I tried to find that play, but you can find not only that play, but at least 10 other plays exactly the same of him getting in the way of shots that are right about to go, and he's last line of defense.
And also the fact, you know, you have to, you know, harken back to the time when they did decide to sign Paul Martin. They didn't want to give Gonchar the extra year. That was probably the right decision because Gonchar doesn't look great right now, and he's got another year on his contract in Ottawa. Having said that, he's a better puck mover than Martin, and you have to wonder if they have some regrets in that respect as well.
Richie,
one other thing. After the game last night, Jaromir Jagr says that Sean Couturier reminds him of a young Ron Francis. Two questions. Is that high praise warranted, at least to the extent of the comment last night?
He's 19 years old. How could it be warranted at this point?
Well, I mean, you're talking about a guy who played with Ron Francis when he was younger. Secondly, if you're a Winnipeg Jets fan, it's so early to say, and it's too early to state, but eventually down the road, is this going to be the Aaron Ward scenario again? Where if people don't remember, the Jets drafted Aaron Ward a pick before Peter Forsberg. So the same scenario is that you pass up maybe the better player. And we won't know this for years and years and years. But I'll tell you this. For a guy to be playing heads up, it's in two games too, although he looked great at the end of the regular season. For a guy to play heads up, guys, against Evgeny Malkin, arguably the best player in the league, second best player in the league when Crosby's healthy.
As it stands now, and yeah, we don't know what's going to happen later in their careers. It's quite clear that Sean Couturier is a better player than Mark Scheifele. Simple. There's no debate. He's a better player. He was drafted a pick behind Mark Scheifele. The Jets have high hopes for Mark Scheifele, and they're hoping that he'll turn into a good center down the line. But Sean Couturier is a better player.
And you have a guy, and you know, it's funny. I was speaking to somebody this morning about it. He's got no teeth. it's almost as if you draft a player and you're Philadelphia and they draft better than anybody, better than Detroit. And they do draft better than anybody. And you think about when a guy gets drafted, I mean, Couturier maybe wasn't known as the hardest nosed guy before he was drafted. It's almost as if that Philly indoctrination that you have. And you just have to play a certain way. You're going to play tough. You're not going to back down from anybody. And I can tell you this. Philly, I've seen many teams play Pittsburgh this year. Philly looks the least intimidated, if intimidated at all, by that Pittsburgh Penguins roster.
Richie, you're right. And Philadelphia and Detroit are probably the two best drafting teams. And your argument that Philly is a better drafting team than Detroit is well warranted.
Remus, if you can pull this up. Sorry, Ezzy, but pull this up. Richard's draft was later in the first round. Carter as well. Both those guys they drafted later in the first round. Giroux, later in the first round. Simon Gagné, later in the first round. Justin Williams, that's just off the top of my head. Those five guys are all bona fide top six players. And I don't think any of those picks at all were in the top 10.
You know, when we talk about organizational culture and the Jets, you can say that Philly has instilled the same thing in all their players. When you put on the Flyers jersey and the Flyers crest, you're pretty much expected to play that type of hard-nosed hockey.
And I'll tell you, it never gets old. I mean, you watched that game last night. That's as good hockey as you're going to see. What I want to do is instead of getting into the other games last night, we're going to carry it over into the next segment, and we're going to preview tonight's matchups and today's matchups, as well as look back on last night's game. That's, of course, including Vancouver, L.A., lots to talk about right after the break. New Jersey, Florida. I mean, it happened, I think it happened. The tree falls in the forest. No. And, of course, we got Detroit, Nashville. Many things to talk about. One question to ponder while we go to break. Was the Bertuzzi-Weber fight a direct result of the NHL not suspending Shea Weber?
Love to see fights in the playoffs.
We're back on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm Richard Pollock, filling in the host seat for Drew Mandel, who's off in Kentucky, about to be wed. To my left, Ezra Ginsberg. To my right, Michael Remus. And across from me, of course, Tim Debenham. You are listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Before the break, we were talking about the Flyers and about their draft picks. So let's.
Wow, we're going to get on the topic of the Flyers drafting, but the Flyers look really good. And I know that, you know, people are already saying that this series is over.
Well, it's not.
Remember in 2000 when the New Jersey Devils went up 2-0 on Philly, they came back. And they didn't win the series, but they won three games in a row. So this series isn't over.
But
Philadelphia has been impressive because, as Winnipeg Jets fans will remember, Philadelphia can score at will. And they can go goal for goal. And Pittsburgh needs to clamp down defensively. It sounds easy. But, you know, they've made turnovers. They've looked sloppy. Mm-hmm. On that first goal, Crosby turned it over. And I'm sure he'd like to have that one back. And they had two forwards chasing. And Jaeger, like you said earlier, Richie, was mismatched against Lovejoy. Lovejoy can't cover Jaeger. Jaeger's still a strong body. But they look unbelievable. And it's a lot of young guys getting it done.
Well, that's
Couturier
it.
And Braden Schenn are young lads.
Well, let's just talk about it right now. Let's talk about their draft picks, Michael.
Okay, 2011, 8th overall, Sean Couturier. 2009, 5th round, 172nd overall, Eric Wellwood, who's playing a big role for them.
Third line center.
2008, 6th round, 178th overall, Zach Rinaldo.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Fourth line left winger.
Yep.
2007, right first round, second pick overall, James Van Riemsdyk.
What about you missed third round Marc-Andre Bourdon, who's been playing, he was injured yesterday. He didn't play yesterday, but he's been playing top 6 minutes for that team. Keep going.
Okay, 2006, second round, 39th pick, Andreas Nodal, who's been playing for Carolina.
Carolina, yep. Yeah.
And then 2006, first round, 22nd overall, Claude Giroux.
22nd overall. So 21 players were drafted before him.
Reem, I just want to cut in here really quickly. And I know Jeff Carter and Mike Richards have since been jettisoned out of town. But you look at Richards, Carter, and Giroux, those are all early 20 to late 20 round, overall picks in the first round. Those
Carter
are all
was
very
11.
Good hockey players. You can make an argument those guys could all have gone in the first five picks.
Yeah.
Carter was
back at it,
Carter was 11, Richards 24 in 2003.
24. I mean, think about that. So I mean, you look at it, and there's more. We could go on and on, but that's a team that doesn't get enough credit in terms of drafting because we hear about the Detroit lore, of course. Quickly, guys, before we go to to Vancouver, LA, and talk about the ramifications of Sedin, the fact that Vancouver is now in a 2-0 hole. Can we talk about you guys were quickly? So we counted for about 30 seconds here. You guys were both at the draft. This past summer.
The 2011 draft in Minneapolis.
Maybe talk about just the reaction. We were talking about the Couturier-Scheifele. Again, this will be going on for years and years. But you guys were at the draft around hockey types. What was the reaction there?
Well, Remus, Kyle, and I were there, and it was an awesome time. Lots of Jets fans, and that's when, of course, Mark Chipman made the team announcement. But it was a bit of a surprise. I mean, the Jets had a high pick there at 7th overall. Sean Couturier, by the way, was at one point, I believe, ranked number one mm-hmm. by Central Scouting.
Yes.
So he fell, and he had some injury problems, and there were some issues about his attitude. But when it came around to the Jets pick, at the time it was the Winnipeg, Manitoba NHL franchise, it turned out to be the Jets. But, you know, we were all expecting, Kyle Kozier and I and Remus were all expecting Sean Couturier to be drafted, you know, based on the fact that he was ranked higher. And so Mark Scheifele, Richie, was a surprise, and he was projected
well,
to go.
What were people saying, though? What was the chatter
Mark,
there?
There was not a lot known about Mark Scheifele. And, you know, we've been around the Jets this year and around training camp and all that, and we've had a chance to interview him. And
he's played quite well, by the way. Let's note he's been played quite well in the
OHL
playoffs.
That's right. He's still a point a game in the playoffs, and he still played very well. He was a late draft year for the OHL. He actually played in the Ontario Junior Hockey League, so he was a year behind. Yeah. He was a late bloomer. Mark Scheifele's a late bloomer, and he's a long-term project. It's quite possible that he'll still play junior next year or St. John. So,
if I recall correctly also, quickly, Michael, Couturier didn't make those Canadian junior teams, and people were skeptical about that. But you look at these Canadian junior teams retroactively, and you look back at some of the rosters, and you know they always put these tough guys out. It's, you know, Canadian hockey, the tough guys out. They didn't pick Nugent Hopkins a year when he was younger, and they didn't pick Sagan when he was a year younger, and they could have a veteran guy who wasn't as talented but could muck it up. I mean, let's not get crazy about the Canadian junior and the way they pick their team sometimes.
Because just because a player selected for the Canadian national junior
doesn't mean
you're not going to be a good player.
There's a lot of junk in that. A lot of those talented players should be making the teams, even as underagers.
If you talk about the NHL draft and want to compare it to like a fantasy draft, when the Jets picked Scheifele, it's like when you're in the fantasy draft and a guy picks a player and you're like, who? And you're like scrolling down. Off the board, a few more pages down on your cheat sheet. And you're like, oh, okay, that's kind of interesting.
And I think, Richie, just to the point, I know you want to go to L.A., Vancouver and preview that game tonight.
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. They played last night. Mark Scheifele, I think has potential. But Sean Couturier is excelling in the NHL now.
Yeah.
And once again, maybe Chevy is regretting that a little bit, and the scouting staff is regretting that a little bit.
But the one thing is, we talk about the draft picks, so we can talk about the free agency all we want. We can talk about trades all you want. This team, they're not going to spend upwards of the halfway point of the cap.
The Jets
are
talking about.
Yes, has to draft well. And
absolutely.
We will see eventually. But if it ends up being that they made a huge gaffe here and they didn't take the consensus guy, they went off the board. And if you go off the board, you better be right. Because if you go off the board and you're wrong, you could cost this team a lot in the future.
Right.
Let's leave it there. I want to talk about Vancouver-LA. People pick Vancouver. I mean, I had Vancouver. I'm now on the basis of Daniel Sedin being
everybody
there.
Picked Vancouver.
Vancouver, no, to go all the way. And, you know, changing the pick from the preseason. Right now, my LA pick for LA could conceivably make it all the way. I'm saying that right now. And I don't think that's going out of bounds. Because I think this West is completely wide open. But let's talk about Vancouver's performance thus far. Is it as simple, Michael, as no Daniel Sedin, or are there bigger, more deep-rooted problems there?
You know, I think no Daniel Sedin is definitely a big issue. You know, when you have this guy who's a top scorer all year, and then you've kind of been, you know, coasting on towards the end, I think, it's definitely an issue. And their defense hasn't played well, and I think we can all agree the problem isn't with their goaltending. If anything, Luongo has kept them in this series.
It's amazing how you mentioned that, because aside from maybe the third goal yesterday, before they're out of it, that was a bad goal, but he's played really well up till then. And all they want to do in Vancouver is blame the goaltending. And you look at this roster and you think, where's the rest of the players? Like, where's the accountability there? You know, they go after Luongo like crazy. He put up great numbers. They're pretty solid numbers this year. Alex Edler had a good year, but what's he been doing? And where's the criticism for a guy like that?
And he has been getting some criticism, and the Vancouver Canucks came into this series first seed in the Western Conference. They had, you know, let's say 9 or 10 less points than last year. They weren't as dominant in the regular season as they were last year.
And they were saying on the broadcast the other night that might be, or last night, or two nights, you know, the first game, that might be good for them. They have found ways to win. I don't think so. They were a dominant team last year. They aren't this year.
Rich, they're not. No, absolutely not. We entered the playoffs under the assumption that Daniel Sedin was going to play in game one. He was practicing with the team.
Absolutely.
And or he would be back in game two. It turns out that the hit to the head that he suffered, the concussion that he suffered as a result of the hit from Duncan Keith, is enough that it's going to keep him out for the first round. And possibly he's not coming back
and
this
year.
And
that's, by the way, if you're just joining us, Daniel Sedin out for the first round, that's been announced. And, you know, it's funny, because we picked him based on Sedin being back. I was in a hockey pool, you guys, on Monday. Sedin skated. I assumed he'd be back. He wasn't on the ice on Tuesday. I was in another pool. I said, I'll nab some Kings. Because without Sedin, it changes everything. And it was on the power play breakout yesterday. And I think it's worked as somewhat of an excuse, too. But the problem with the Sedins is, it seems like, not that Henrik can't play without Daniel, but he just isn't as dominant. And the puck possession isn't as dominant. And it's almost as if you lose one, you lose one and a half.
Well, when you put Max LaPerriere on your top scoring line, I don't
think... LaPerriere.
That's why I said LaPerriere.
You said LaPerriere.
Did I?
That's fine.
You know what?
We know what you were talking about, Reem.
Okay, well, you know, I was going to go on and talk about the Kings. This is a team that had to, you know, claw their way into the playoffs. They played a lot of meaningful games near the end of the season, a lot of games for the division with the Sharks. They kind of were in that, you know, mindset, you know, must win for the last part of the season, while the Canucks were coasting. And you see this a lot in sports. You saw this with the Giants in football,
yep,
the Cardinals in baseball, where a team goes on a run at the end of the season to get into the playoffs, and then they just take that momentum and run with it.
And Areem, what you've got now is with no Daniel Sedin in the lineup, you've got Mason Raymond on the top line, and then you've got Chris Higgins, and you're right, LaPerriere did spend a little bit of time, but you've got the American Express line, and now you've got a second line that isn't as dominant. So now you've got no Daniel Sedin, and Ryan Kessler isn't playing like he was last year,
and that
equals limited offense.
There's two other big problems for them, Mike Richards and Jonathan Quick. We're going to leave it there. We're going to speak to Mike Colligan, HockeyWriters.com, Forbes Sports Money. He's going to come on and talk about the Penguins. Down 0-2.
Not a lot of people thought that was going
to
happen.
Heading to Philadelphia, one of the toughest places to play in the National Hockey League. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, live on TSN 1290. Past the hour on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, I'm Richard Pollock, filling in for Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg, Michael Remus, and of course, producer Tim.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Pittsburgh Philly has been, the first two games have been absolutely unbelievable in terms of excitement and a little bit old-fashioned hockey. We're joined on the line now by Mike Colligan of HockeyWriters.com and Forbes Sports Money to discuss the series. Mike, first question, how surprised are you with the way the first two games have materialized?
Well, you know, I don't think I'm surprised with the results. Two pretty close games overall, but I've been pretty surprised with how they've unfolded. You know, I've seen two games now in a row, and actually this has been the story throughout much of the season series between these two teams, where Philadelphia has just been nowhere to be found for about 20 or 25 minutes, and it seems like the Penguins just have their way. They get up two or three goals, and every single time in this season series this year, Philadelphia has called their timeout, you know, gathered themselves, and then found a way to storm back. And I think that's the surprising thing to me, is you rarely see a team surrender a three-goal lead in the playoffs, and we've now seen the Penguins give up this lead over and over again to the Flyers. And I think, you know, that's really the surprising factor to me, is that the way it's happening is just really has to be taking a toll on the Penguins' psyche at this point.
You had a quote in an article you wrote after game one from Brooks Orpik. I'm going to read it here. We watched a lot of video, and the problem was just our approach to the game. When you get a three-goal lead like that, Orpik said, I think you have to look more at winning the game 3-0 rather than chasing the fourth goal. Now, yesterday they got out to a 2-0 lead, but is there one thing that you can maybe point to, Mike, as the reason behind the blown leads?
Well, you know, when you get in that situation in the playoffs, I think you want to focus on defense. You know, you've got a 2 or 3 goal lead. You don't need to keep pushing and try to make it 6-0. And I think that was definitely the case in that first game, where the Penguins, you know, that they came into the playoffs. John Tortorella called them an arrogant organization. I don't think that's necessarily the case, but I think they know they're a very, very good team. And I think when they got up 3-0 that quickly in game one, they thought, okay, we're going to cruise here. Let's start to get fancy, some behind-the-back passes. And, you know, we see so many of these overconfident teams kind of unravel that way. But I think another problem is the Penguins just aren't that good defensively, and it's been a concern for me all year. Mm-hmm. Even in the 11-game winning streak that they had a couple months ago, I was looking at them letting up 5 goals to the Winnipeg Jets and Toronto Maple Leafs and letting up a ton of goals. And fortunately for them, they were scoring 7 and 8 a night, and that kind of covered up the defensive weaknesses that were there. But I think now we're seeing that come back to haunt them a bit. Marc-Andre Fleury's not playing at the level he was throughout much of the year, and I think so now we're seeing some of these defensive holes exposed on the Penguins.
Mike, you mentioned the defense, and we were watching the game yesterday, and you know, Ben Lovejoy came in for game 2 and he didn't have a strong game. He had the turnover that led to Couturier's goal. Paul Martin, even though he got a very key goal, you know, he struggled a little bit. How much is the defensive play of those two guys costing them right now?
Yeah, you know, Ben Lovejoy, he had knee surgery about 2 weeks ago. That was his first game back, so I was trying to give him the benefit of the doubt there because I was just shocked he was on the ice at all in that situation. But Paul Martin, it's kind of been the story of the year here in Pittsburgh, is as the highest-paid defenseman, he's got 3 years left at $5 million and certainly not playing to that level of hockey in Pittsburgh. Now, they went out, they got him on the free agent market. The nature of free agency is overpaying for guys. And I think when you look at someone like Chris Letang earning $3.5 million, maybe you balance out some of that overpayment, underpayment. But they really need more out of Paul Martin because, quite frankly, they're two defensemen short of a solid top four, yeah, at least one that can make them last through a couple rounds in the playoffs. So I think Martin has really stood out as a guy that has lost all confidence and quite frankly, just doesn't want to touch the puck at this point. Make sure he's second to every loose puck, and I think that's a huge problem for the Penguins because they rely on him to play 24, 25 minutes a night in some very important situations.
We're joined on the line by Mike Colligan.
We've mentioned the struggles the Penguins have had on defense. Can we expect any lineup changes heading into Philadelphia?
You know, one guy that has not gotten any attention this year out of Pittsburgh is Matt Niskanen. He came over in the James Neal deadline deal last year and really struggled down the stretch and, you know, was one of their big weaknesses in the playoffs last year. Well, he really turned his game around this season. I think was quietly one of their best defensemen, at least year-long, was just solid on the blue line there, and he's been out with struggling with what seems like a shoulder injury. He was out for some games at the end of the year and hasn't been back in the playoffs, and I think that's a big factor, is losing him and losing his solid all-around play. Like I said, now you're playing Paul Martin 25 minutes. They're really extending Chris Letang, and so I wonder if Niskanen could get back into the lineup. There's talk that he practiced today. I hope he's not forcing himself back in the lineup in a desperate situation, but they kind of need that. They need a guy that can really shut things down on defense because Philadelphia has shown the ability to cash in on every opportunity they get. You know, they're not getting many in early in these games, but when they get them, breakaways and two-on-ones, they're scoring almost every single time. And like I said, that's where they usually were having Fleury backing them, coming up with the big save, and that's not happening. And so that becomes kind of a recipe for disaster, and I think it's why we saw, you know, 7 real goals last night and also an empty netter to make it 8.
Mike, Pierre Laviolette seems to have been able so far through 2 games to have been getting the matchups that he's wanted, even though he's been on the road. Is there any concern that you have maybe of a specific matchup that Dan Bylsma may not be able to get when he's in Philly?
Well, I think you mentioned Laviolette's been dictating the line matchups, and that's surprising, being the road team, mm-hmm. that he was able to get just about every matchup that he wanted. You know, I've seen him trying to get Grossman and Coburn, the two physical defensemen on the Flyers, out there against Malkin, and we've really seen Malkin be invisible in this series. I mean, nowhere to be found, very little production and very little offensive opportunities. So I think they've been doing a very good job, and I think you have to give credit to Sean Couturier as well for the defensive efforts he's had. But I think you're also seeing them match up Matt Carl and Kimmo Timonen, two, mm-hmm. you know, quicker defensemen against the line of Sidney Crosby because there's a lot of speed there, and I think they've done a good job handling Crosby. And more often than not, Laviolette has gotten those matchups, and that's kind of hard to believe on the road. I think Bylsma's maybe, I don't want to say overconfident, but he's thinking, okay, I don't really want to go too crazy trying to match lines where you're throwing guys on and off the ice and really getting out of the rhythm of the game. But when now you go into Philadelphia where they can have those matchups at will, that's certainly a concern for me, because Malkin's line, after being one of the hottest all season, just has been nowhere to be found. I think James Neal might be struggling with a little bit of an injury lingering from the end of the season, but if they can't get away from Couturier and those two physical defensemen, that's a huge concern for the Penguins on the road, I think.
Mike, the Penguins are down 2-0 here, but this is a best of seven series, and I think it's pretty ridiculous that people are already crowning the Flyers and saying the series is over. In your opinion, what do the Penguins have to do to get back in the series in Philly?
That's a great question. I mean, and I agree, it's hard to really jump to conclusions on this series. I think we're seeing just two very good teams in this first round matchup, and it's almost a shame that one of them is going to be bounced after a couple games here, because it's just, I think two of the two best teams in the Eastern Conference battling each other. And from the Penguins' perspective, I think they need to just continue to play their style of hockey, which is moving the puck quickly up ice, getting it in behind the Flyers' defensemen, and then being physical with them. They've had a lot of big hits on some of those guys, and I'm wondering if once you get into game four or five, if you really start to pound those defensemen, are we going to see some, you know, long-term effects on those guys? Because Nicholas Grossman's coming off of a knee injury. You know, how long can he hold up if he continues to take a punishment? And I think that's the thing, is that these have been very close games. I mean, it's not like the Penguins are getting blown out by any means. It's just a Philadelphia team that's gotten a little bit of luck. You know, they had an offside goal that was allowed in game one. They had some weird shorthanded opportunities last night, and they're cashing in on those opportunities, like I said before. So certainly not a case of, reinventing the wheel for Dan Bylsma. I think if you just continue to play this way, maybe get some better goaltending from Marc-Andre Fleury, they certainly have the firepower to, you know, I wouldn't be shocked if they won four out of the next five in this series, just the way these two teams are so evenly matched.
So you said you wouldn't be shocked if they won next four of the next five, but do you think they will come back from this deficit?
Well, I saw a stat that teams that are down 2-0 win about 13% of the series. Wow. I think, you know, it's something that the Penguins, it's going to be tough. It's going to be very difficult for Pittsburgh to go into Philadelphia and probably have to win both of those games, but maybe they can just get the distractions of home ice off, and sometimes you see teams really bounce back. I give them a little bit more of a chance than maybe Vancouver in that situation, facing the 0-2 deficit, but certainly won't be easy. But I think when you have the firepower up front, you're almost never out of a series, and the Penguins led the league in goal scoring this year, and now they've got Sidney Crosby, I think, has been playing excellent, and if he can continue to lead the team, you know, this is what he's kind of been waiting for, is the opportunity to get back in there and guide this team through. And I think that's where you see what a team's made of. You see what they can do in these tough situations. And Pittsburgh was down 2-0 in two series in their Stanley Cup run in the 2009 year. So they've certainly been here before. It's a very similar core and a similar group of guys, and they certainly know they can do it again.
I agree with you, Mike. I think it's far from over, and I think there's still a lot of good games to come.
It'll definitely, Mike, be very interesting to see how the rest of this series materializes. Thank you for your time, as always, and we'll speak to you soon.
Absolutely, guys. Anytime.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
That's Mike Colligan, HockeyWriters.com, Forbes Sports Money. On the other side, Josh Cooper, the Tennessean, to break down the Nashville perspective of the Predators versus the Red Wings. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, live on Sports Radio 1290. I'm already taking flack from Ezzie Ginsburg over here.
Richie, before the break, did you say Sports Radio 1290?
Yeah, apparently I did.
I'm just glad that you didn't say the college station that we used to be on, Kick FM. We've been on three stations, but Sports Radio 1290, that's where we got our start. Same station, really, but
it's the same station.
Yeah,
I just, you know, we've been here for a while. And
CFRW.
I still, yes, exactly.
CFRW 1290. It's all the same thing
with CFRW. Quarter to the top of the hour. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm Richard Pollock, filling in the host chair for Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Michael Remus and Ezra Ginsburg, and of course producer Tim. And on the line, we have Josh Cooper.
Now let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Josh Cooper of the Tennessean, welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us, Josh. you wrote in the Tennessean, you obviously write for the Tennessean about the Predators as well as a blog you have. Before we get into some of the anecdotes that you had in there over the past couple of days, you know, to the point, was the Weber incident, obviously with Henrik Zetterberg, did that incident cause any form of distraction for the Predators heading into last night's game?
I don't think it caused any form of distraction. If anything, it seemed like it caused some sort of motivation for the Red Wings. And you saw Todd Bertuzzi take matters into his own hands at the start of the game and basically got into a fight with Shea Weber. You know, on top of that, too, there was a delayed penalty that happened on the fight, before the fight, actually, that was on Detroit. And Weber acknowledged after the game that he knew it was a delayed penalty and still fought anyway. So, I don't think it was a distraction when he got to the game. I do think it motivated Detroit. And at the same time, I think that during the game, it was that one fight that kind of, I guess, stemmed from the Zetterberg incident really hurt the Predators in that their first power play of the game, just 2 minutes into the game, they couldn't score.
Right.
Whoever wasn't on the ice.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess maybe the roundabout answer your question. I guess it kind of ended up being somewhat of a distraction for them.
Josh, the Predators had the top-ranked power play in the NHL during the regular season, but they've struggled big time here in the first two games against the Red Wings. Why was the power play so successful, you know, in the regular season, but, you know, they haven't been able to get it going, albeit in only two games?
Well, you know, I think that a few reasons. One is they've always had issues adjusting to pressure. When you pressure their points and kind of pressure their guys down low, you have to force them to move the puck around. There's an adjustment period for them. And, you know, it takes about one or two games for that to happen, for them to realize what the other team is doing and how to deal with it. So I think that that's why it hasn't been very good this year, is that the Red Wings are pressuring them all over the ice. They're sending in one forechecker. They're pressuring their points and forcing Nashville to make passes all around the offensive zone. In terms of why it was good during the regular season, pretty much because they were able to react to such situations. They never got stale. They kept passing the puck. They kept finding other options. They didn't just rely on Shea Weber and his big shots. So, you know, I think that's why it was successful in the regular season. In the postseason, they just kind of need to make a few tinkers here and there, and I think they will probably be back on their way. But, yes, you're right. I mean, 0-for-12 on the power play. They had three straight power plays, including a 30-second 5-on-3 to start the second period yesterday, and they were down 2-0. You've got to convert on one of those to get back in the game.
Josh, do you think that some people in the Nashville organization are worried that, you know, the series is tied 1-1 and you haven't really seen the best of Datsyuk or Zetterberg yet?
You know, I was thinking about that, too. I mean, you have Zetterberg has one goal. Datsyuk has, I think it's just one secondary assist, and it's a total non-factor this whole series. I'm sure that has to be a worry. At the same time, you know, the Fisher-Kapitsin-Erab line hasn't exactly performed for the Predators, too. Yesterday, you finally saw the Leguan line kind of working a little bit better and getting some scoring opportunities. So, you know, I think that there has to be some sort of worry in that regard, just in the sense that you are keeping their best players off the score sheet and you're still not winning the series. I mean, if you had probably told the Predators before the series that between them, Datsyuk and Zetterberg would have 2 points in the first two games combined, I think they would take that and think that they'd be up 2-0. That's clearly not the case.
Joined by Josh Cooper of the Tennessean, talking about the Nashville Predators versus Detroit Red Wings series, with the series headed to Joe Louis Arena, tied at 1. Josh, a key acquisition prior to the deadline was that of veteran Hal Gill. We were just talking a couple segments ago about how Pittsburgh seems to kind of be missing a player like Gill. How much are the Predators missing Gill, and when do you expect him to return, if at all, in this series?
Well, you know, I think that I wouldn't say they're missing him too much right now, just because of the penalty kill. They've actually done fairly well. I mean, when you give a team 8 power plays like they gave Detroit the other day, of course they're going to score. You know, but I don't think they're quite missing him yet. But I still think that not having him, not having his size, his intimidation factor, his presence, will eventually wear them down in the series and will play a role. They definitely need him back, no question.
Josh, we had you on a few weeks ago, and we were talking about Alexander Radulov. And, you know, he sent shockwaves, if you want to call it that, when he made his return to Nashville after playing in the Russian Continental League. How do you think he's done so far in his first two games in the playoffs?
Poor the first game, really good the second game. Probably their best forward, along with Andrei Kuznetsov, in the second game. Was keeping plays alive, forcing plays, had tons of scoring chances. Set up Andrei Kuznetsov on a lot of scoring chances as well. And, you know, I think that... One of the key ingredients for the Predators this year in the playoffs in comparison to previous years is the fact they have someone like him, and also Andrei Kuznetsov as well, two big bodies who plays. And I think that that sort of can really lend to helping them out as the series goes on. When you have forwards that keep kind of coming in the offensive zone, the forecheck, and ramming themselves into defensemen, you're going to eventually wear them down.
Josh, the Predators have been known as collectively a good defensive team. What's one thing they've been able to take away from Detroit that the Red Wings do really well?
Pavel Datsyuk, he's been an absolute non-factor. Hasn't really made any good plays whatsoever. I think they've knocked him down maybe two or three times. I don't know if this has to do with matchups or getting the Mike Fisher line against them every shift, but he has been that. I mean, he was a guy who before the series we all thought would just take over the series, especially how he played the end of the regular season. He has not looked anything like the Pavel Datsyuk I remember in the series. So I don't know how much that's Nashville. I don't know how much that's his coming back from his knee surgery. But being able to take him away, I mean, that's, you're taking away one of the two, maybe the most dangerous player in the NHL.
Josh?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, you said that. Okay.
That was my thought.
Okay. One question, you know, Mike Babcock and Barry Trotz are, you could argue, you know, two of the best few coaches in the National Hockey League, in the top five almost certainly. What has the chess match been like between the two of them? Have you seen one coach maybe get an advantage over the other?
Not really yet. I mean, just simply because it's, you know, you can't really, and Babcock said, you know, I guess in the series opening press conference that he really thought that the Detroit line 3 and 4 were better than Nashville's 3rd and 4th line, and Predators' 3rd and 4th line went out there and scored 3 goals in game one. You know, and then second game, he was able to adjust to that Darren Helm, and their 3rd and 4th line played really well. So it's tough to really tell right now. I think that, you know, they're both very well-coached teams. I think, you know, what Babcock sort of has is that trust factor, that he's won a Stanley Cup. He knows how to get there. He's been to 3 Stanley Cup finals. Barry Trotz doesn't have that. So until you know, the Preds can break through with Barry Trotz, if they ever do break through with Barry Trotz, you know, we will be questioning that, and you know, that's something that we have to look at with Babcock, is that he knows how to get there, he knows how to manage the chess match, he knows how to work the mind games, and you know, I don't know if Barry Trotz knows how to do that quite as well yet.
You had written about that in the Tennessean. Were you surprised that Babcock kind of called out essentially the Nashville depth lines?
Not at all. It's the postseason, you know, you're you're playing mind games. You're trying to get underneath the other team's skin. You're trying to motivate guys, demotivate guys, try to get whatever advantage you have. So I'm not surprised at all he did that.
You know, back to the beginning of the interview when we asked you about the Weber and Bertuzzi fight, what was the reaction and maybe the feeling in the Nashville organization prior to Brendan Shanahan's ruling or non-ruling, really?
They thought it wasn't going to be a suspension. They strongly thought it wasn't. They thought it was a hockey play. They thought that it wasn't as bad as it looked, which was the tagline in Nashville. And, you know, I mean, my dad's a lawyer, and he always tells me, you know, when you're dealing with arguments and such, that there's 3 sides to every story.
Yeah.
There's what he said, there's what she said, and there's the truth.
Yeah.
So you have the Predators saying it's not as bad as it looks. You have Henrik Zetterberg with this mysterious cracked helmet that the Red Wings can't seem to offer up to anyone, and saying that he was dizzy, which, I mean, what definitely indicated concussion, but yet he can still continue to play. So, I mean, there's it's tough to really tell. I mean, I think that, you know, it's somewhere in the middle of Zetterberg being dizzy and the cracked helmet and Weber saying it wasn't as bad as it looked.
Josh, the series is obviously all tied up, so it's essentially a best of 5, and it's going back to Detroit for Sunday's game. It's an early start, 11 o'clock Central. What do you think the key is for Nashville to, you know, take back control of this series?
Keep pounding Detroit's D. I mean, last night it was interesting. One of the, I think it was the Detroit reporters, asked Mike Babcock about Nicholas Lidstrom not being out there in the 5-on-3. And he basically referenced that Lidstrom's ankle was still bothering him. I mean, Detroit is old. They're a banged-up team. I mean, it's, to be quite honest, like, just kind of watching the series, if they win the series, I really do have a hard time seeing them going far in the playoffs considering their injuries and their age. Just got to keep taking the body and keep working them. And I think that if they keep doing that and keep working over their D, they'll have some results. They keep kind of, you know, playing ticky-tack with their passes and being too cute and not being physical enough, and I think Detroit can capitalize.
Couldn't agree more, Josh. That's great analysis. Appreciate your time, as always. Enjoy tomorrow's game and enjoy Detroit.
No worries. Anytime. And, yes, I will try to enjoy Detroit.
Stay safe. Josh Cooper of the Tennessean. that series is going to be really interesting moving forward. And I think Josh is bang on about the veterans in terms of, you watch Nicholas Lidstrom, it's the first time in this series really seen him look almost like a shadow of his former self. So very effective.
Right. And, and Josh mentioned too, Richie, you know, that in this series, the Kostitsyn Irat Fisher line hasn't done anything. Yeah. The power play has been brutal. They actually, you know, played Detroit pretty well. These have been close games. I think all of us predicted 6 or 7 games, and this is a series to watch. Pittsburgh, Philly's high scoring, but these are two very, very good teams.
It'll be certainly interesting to see how this whole series materializes. I took Detroit in 6. I still think that their offensive talent may carry the day. I didn't take them to go far, though. And Babcock is as good of a coach as you're going to get. So
best of five series now?
Yeah, you know what? And not yet that coin. It's the series essentially is a coin flip, though, because who knows which way it's going to go. Do you guys believe we already finished 1 hour of the show?
It's going by quick.
Pretty quick.
Well, it goes by quicker when Drew isn't talking about his breakfast, so.
Well, you know, there's only so much Drew one can handle.
Yeah, that's
on the
true.
Other side of the break, we're going to talk about whether or not the LA Kings Twitter controversy was much ado about nothing. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. 1 hour down, 2 to go on a somewhat beautiful, I wouldn't say it's beautiful, Saturday afternoon in Winnipeg.
Well, it might not be that beautiful outside, but it's beautiful in here. The air is fresher. There's more air time without Drew here.
There is more air time. I wouldn't say the air is any fresher.
Well, just it's generally a more
could use a fan in here.
Yeah, we could use a little bit of a fan. Air conditioning.
Richard Pollock sitting in the host chair for Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg, Michael Remus, and of course, producer Tim. This segment is brought to you by the Chair Bar and Grill. Located in the heart of Osborne Village at Stradbrook and Osborne, catch all the home team's games on their numerous HD big screens. Be sure to join Illegal Curve Hockey for their weekly appearances at the Chair Bar and Grill. We'll be there at least once this week to watch the Flyers. You know, I'm thinking we're going to go there at least once. Great setup. They've done some renovations. At least be there for one of the Philly-Pittsburgh games, if not a couple of them over the next week or so.
Everyone is talking about this Philly-Pittsburgh series, and rightly so. It's been very good, and you know, Philly's upsetting Pittsburgh right now. But you know, transitioning Richie to Vancouver and LA, and the Twitter controversy after the first game.
Well,
this series has been pretty good because not a lot of people were picking LA to win the series,
but not a lot of people knew that Daniel Sedin wouldn't be playing, and I think that's obviously the wild card.
Yep.
Let's talk about the tweet after Game 1 of the Canucks Kings series. Somebody from the Los Angeles Kings official Twitter tweeted, essentially, to paraphrase, very little paraphrase, but Remus, you have the tweet up here, so why don't you read the actual tweet from the Kings, because it's about as funny as you can get.
Oh, I can't pull it up. It's from a few days ago.
I got it right here, Richie. I mean, it was from the actual tweet was, after the Kings won Game 1, it was, to everyone in Canada outside BC, you're welcome.
First of all, it's hilarious. My comment on it, before I throw it to you guys, would be, don't take Twitter so seriously. And Twitter is for one. Eric DeHatch wrote about this. Twitter is for one-liners. It's funny. And the truth be told, again, people hate the truth, obviously, because everybody outside Vancouver does hate the Canucks. Let's be real here.
I would agree. I mean, a lot of people don't like the Canucks. They call them divers. They call them cheap shot artists.
Which they are.
And you know, that's fair. But I think the issue here is, this is the LA Kings Twitter account. It's a professional account for a professional organization.
Yep.
Should they be tweeting, you know, tongue-in-cheek jokes like that? Well, I'll say that I do agree with Eric. I think this joke is completely harmless. It doesn't hurt anyone. I think it's funny, but if that's what they want to do for their account, then I think go right ahead.
More people will follow the account. If you see the picture of the tweet, there's retweets, there's favorites, upwards of, I think, 100 now.
Richie, I think it might be not that professional to tweet that from the LA Kings account, but it is funny. I think there's a good chance that a Canadian tweeted this.
Very possible. I mean, truth be told, Ezzy, much of the staff of the Kings is Canadian. You got Sutter,
and people living in California that like hockey.
That's also true.
Look, the argument is the Kings have 83,000 followers right now. I think it's gone up considerably since that tweet. But the Kings are in a pretty saturated sports market with a large population.
Great point.
And they have to compete in their same building with the Clippers and the Lakers. Not to mention they have to compete with USC. and you know, among other
UCLA,
you know,
USC football, UCLA basketball.
Look, hockey is at the, you know, the bottom of the sports page in the States, and if this gets you to the front, you know, good for them.
And it's LA.
It means they've done their job.
That's right.
And guys, LA. I don't think the issue here is what should and shouldn't be tweeted from a National Hockey League team's Twitter account. In this day and age of a lot of political correctness, and we're not seeing that in the Philly-Pittsburgh series, we're obviously not seeing this in the Nashville-Detroit series, where you're seeing teams go at each other, I think it's fine to have some natural hatred in a series. I mean, L.A. and Vancouver are fighting to go to the next round. This is the Stanley Cup playoffs. This is hockey. It's a war. This is good-natured, and it's fun, and there should be more of this. It's not like a certain guy is getting called out or anybody's insulting anybody, or it's all in good-natured fun.
Is that right, Ezzy?
You know what? That's amazing.
I didn't realize Drew was here.
Yeah, I didn't realize Drew was here either.
I am Drew Mandel.
Where did Drew come from?
Love it.
That's right.
Remus with a great job there. Nothing better than Drew's sound drops are better than Drew.
I'm going to agree with Richard.
with all of the sound bites that we have from Drew, Drew could actually host the show right now.
There you have it.
Amazing.
I want to transition though quickly from the Twitter controversy. I think we are all in agreement that there's nothing wrong with that tweet.
No. You know what it is, really, Richie. In all seriousness, it's a spirit of competition.
It is.
I mean,
as Drew would say, to the victor go the spoils.
Exactly.
And they can do that. And you know what, Vancouver, if you want to shut them up, win. Yeah. And right now they're not winning. Another Vancouver player who created a little bit of controversy. Again, these people, people have nothing to talk about, which is why we're going to rip them on this show talking about it. Corey Schneider, who I think we may...
Some people think he's going to come in for game 3.
I think they might need a spark, right? You got to take a chance there. Yeah. So I don't think there's any harm in doing it.
Richie, let's get this out of the way right away. The first two games are by no means Roberto Luongo's fault. And if anybody thinks that they're not getting good goaltending, yeah, maybe one or two of the goals of the 8 goals, there's been an empty netter. So let's say one or two of the goals haven't been the best, but Dustin Brown scoring on a breakaway, that wasn't his fault.
No, Dan Hamm, who's falling there, other plays that they've made, you know, Edler's awful turnover yesterday. You don't drop that pass on a breakout on the power play if you see the guy cheating to accept it, to intercept the pass. You just go forward. He's not playing with confidence. Back to Schneider, though. He made comments. The Canucks have been getting a lot of hate this week. And the playoffs started, people came back to hating the Canucks. Hence the tweet from LA, you know, playing on that. Schneider said about the hate the Canucks have been getting, nobody cares about Edmonton, so nobody hates them. It's that simple. That was the quote.
Well, that's not true. The Oilers have tons of fans all across Canada.
Well, his point was that they're not the point of content. Nobody actually cares about them because they haven't been in the playoffs, so nobody hates them.
The Oilers are going to be a pretty good team in a couple of years with all of the first overall draft picks that they have. It's not going to be long before Edmonton's back in the playoffs.
In terms of the comment, to me, once again, it's true. Nobody cares about Edmonton right now because they're not in the playoffs. And then he has to go issue a formal apology for that comment. Have we taken things out of control here?
Did he really issue an apology for that? I kind of agree. I agree with him. I mean, look, he's saying it's true. And some people, you know, with the LA Kings tweet, they can't accept the truth. The fact of the matter is Vancouver's on TV every night. They have a lot of players that people don't like. Their fans started a riot and destroyed their city. It's, if you're a hockey fan, it's pretty easy to hate them.
To quote Schneider, it probably wasn't the best choice of words, and I apologize for it. I didn't mean to create a distraction, and hopefully it won't affect us in any other way going forward.
Richie, you know what type of the modern times that we live in with Twitter and media and every single hockey game and every highlight being broadcast again and again until the next game? We're in the day and age that a player or a team is personally attacked. 4 hours or 6 hours earlier, and then they're interviewed about it after the game, and they respond to that attack that on their team or their person, if you want to call it that, a personal attack on them, and then they get in trouble for responding and doing their part by still contributing to the story, and then nobody wins. It's insults and name calling back and forth. And as far as I'm concerned, you can still defend your team and yourself and not have to apologize for it. You shouldn't ever have to apologize or defend your actions. Back to the Timmy Thomas thing. If he wants to have an opinion, he should not be held to a different standard, and it should not be held against him. If he wants to express himself on Twitter, on Facebook, right. on TV, he should have that right.
It's a classic catch-22. You always want the players to say more, and then when they say more, you make a big deal out of it, and then they want to say less.
You know, just to switch topics for now, Tim Thomas, you know, they're playing in Washington this week. He was asked about, you know, the White House comments, and he promptly stopped the scrum and said thank you and walked out. Do you think that was the right move for him?
You know what? He doesn't want to talk about it anymore. I don't have an issue with it. He gave them a forewarning. If you bring it up, I'm not going to talk about it. And they asked him, fine, and he left. Fine.
I have no problem with that. I really like Tim Thomas. And I think in this day and age, as a goalie and as a person, his character, and I think in this day and age, when you are able to express yourself, you might not agree with it, but you're doing it. And it seems that nowadays, if you don't talk to the media...
That's a spirit of sport.
It's a polarizing thing. If you don't talk to the media, people don't know what you're really thinking, and people think that you're hiding something or you're negative, you're anti-media.
That's a spirit of sport and society as a whole. That's why people love sport. You have a guy like Tim Thomas playing on a team with Andrew Ferentz, who's as left-wing as they get. Tim Thomas is extremely right-wing. They play on the same team.
It's funny because neither of them are forwards.
They play in the
like
same,
that joke?
Well done. They play on the same team. Okay? They are working towards the same goal. There's a certain harmony there. They won the cup last year. You can have different points of view and still work together. And you don't need to be called out for one view as opposed to another. It ends up being, and don't get me wrong, I'm not saying I agree with Tim Thomas. In fact, I don't. But just because he has a point of view that you don't agree with doesn't mean he's not entitled to that point of view. And if you're not going to ask Andrew Ferentz about his thoughts on things all the time, because he's been quite active, then don't ask Tim Thomas about it all the time. Because generally speaking, the media is going to ask him because they're a little bit more liberal. Just get over it.
And
it's enough already.
Doesn't it get back to, you know, having a sense of humor and what Remus said? This is funny. I mean, what the LA Kings tweeted was funny. Well, in my opinion, in our opinion, maybe some people, Canucks fans, probably didn't find it funny. But in this day and age, yep. where... Everybody hears about everything within a minute because somebody tweets about it, then it gets retweeted right. 50 times. You have to have a sense of humor about things, and you have to expect that people are going to have opinions. We're not all, introverts. You know, there are a lot of extroverts in sports. Sports is highly emotionally charged.
And the idea of politics is that people have differing point of views, and there isn't a right view or a wrong view. You know, some people believe there's a right view and a wrong view. That's fine. But you're allowed and you're entitled to your opinion. And you're allowed and entitled to criticize Edmonton Oilers for being a joke of an organization for the past couple of years. And you're allowed to criticize Vancouver for diving around. And whether you believe that to be true or not true, it's funny. It's sports. It's light. And the world is an intense place sometimes. It's supposed to be fun. And you're supposed to have fun with it.
You know, it's not the end of the world here. But I think the thing with this tweet is, you know, it's the playoffs. And you see on the ice... The intensity of the playoffs games is nothing compared to the regular season. It seems nothing. Like every time, you know, there's a whistle, there's some kind of scrum after, people are getting face washed. And maybe they just took this tweet, you know, said it's a playoffs, you know, this means war between, you know, our city and their city.
Remus, we have no idea if the Vancouver Canucks as an organization and in the dressing room are talking about this at all. But if they are, they have much larger problems. They should be worried about how they're containing Andrei Kopitar, Dustin Brown, and Justin Williams, not what tweet is coming from the Los Angeles Kings Twitter account. It's so meaningless, really, if you think about it.
To Alain Vigneault's credit, he said, I don't have to worry about Twitter. I mean, it's Twitter. And I think he handles the media actually as well as any coach does. And I think he played, he made some comments about his team, his players, which we're going to talk about later. And I like the way he actually does that. Yep. Former coach, of course, of the Manitoba Moose, and he's been a coach. People didn't think that he'd actually last in Vancouver after Mike Gill hired
him. He's had more success than any Canucks coach in a very long time, since maybe Pat Quinn.
Has taken to him, yeah. Good point, Pat Quinn. Quarter after the hour, you're listening to the Legal Curve Hockey Show. On the other side of the break, we're going to discuss whether or not Shea Weber should have been suspended for his turnbuckle, hit, head smash, play of Red Wing star Henrik Zetterberg. You're listening to the Legal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Yes. 17 past the hour, live from South Winnipeg on Pembina Highway. You're listening to the Legal Curve Hockey Show. Filling in the host chair for Drew Mandel, I'm Richard Pollock. Joined in studio by Michael Remus, Ezra Ginsberg, and producer Tim. Before the break, we asked I asked a rhetorical question, which is not going to be rhetorical anymore. The question, of course, was, I'm going to throw it to both of you guys. Why? Well, let's ask. Put it this way. Why wasn't Shea Weber suspended for his head smash of Red Wings star Henrik Zetterberg?
Well, the only answer that I can come up with is that Brendan Shanahan and NHL senior management, senior operations, didn't think it was severe enough to warrant a suspension. And that's quite obvious. As far as my own personal opinion, I think you have to suspend him at least one game. And now he got the $2,500 fine. You know what that is, Richie?
That's a dollar for me.
That's a tiny, yeah.
It's a dollar for me.
That's a little tiny. That's a tiny slap on the wrist.
Can I cut
a little? It's a little flick, a little pinch.
Let
it's
me ask
nothing.
You this, Ezzy. And now you need to throw to Remus after this. Are we at a point now where there's rules for star players and there are rules for depth players?
You know, I think after looking at this, it's pretty obvious. I mean, Byron Bitts, he's a third, fourth-line guy. You know, he's had to work hard. I'm pretty sure he missed a lot of this season or last season. And he delivered a check to the head of Kyle Clifford and got suspended. I mean, the only difference between these two hits is that Kyle Clifford was injured and sat out, and Henrik Zetterberg did not. And I think that's, other than, you know, the obvious fact that Shea Weber is a star player, and Bitts is not, the fact that Zetterberg, you know, was fine and returned for the next game, I think, played a factor. And you have to say it did.
It's a factor. Sure, you know, the injury is a factor, and if you're going to go to court, the result of something is a factor. But let's talk about the action itself.
If you, Richie, okay, these were different incidents because there was one that was a boarding and the one was driving someone's head into the glass, turnbuckle WWE style. And if you juxtapose the two incidents, and forget the fact that they are two different types of aggression or violence, but if you still juxtapose them for the end result, because they were both violent.
They were. I mean, I don't...
One of them doesn't... You could make a strong argument that Weber should be suspended for 2 to 3 games. You could make a strong argument because it was violent and it was unnecessary. He took someone's head and rammed it. That was ultra aggressive. And, you know, Byron Bitts, he's bounced around. He's in his late 20s. He's a big grinder. He's a fourth line fighter. He's a grinder. He's not going to be a big factor in the Vancouver LA series, but that shouldn't matter. The point that we're at in the National Hockey League is that we're trying to make it a safer game.
That's the point, Ezzy. Let me get into it. That's the point. It's safety. And if somebody, if Byron Bitts picks up your head and smashes into the glass, or Shea Weber does it, it's the same action and should warrant the same suspension.
Richie, I'm going to put it in another way, and I think you guys would agree with this. If Byron Bitts, and I think this is how it works in real life. If Byron Bitts does that to Henrik Zetterberg, he gets, not only does he get 2 or 3 games easy, he might get 5 games.
I agree.
He might get 10 games.
I agree.
And Shea Weber might win the Norris Trophy this year. And you know how much I love Shea Weber. He's a great defenseman.
Great.
But at the end of that game, when Nashville was up 3-2, and Henrik Zetterberg hit him from behind or slashed him on the ankles or whatever he did, and he reacted by throwing his head into the glass, it was an error in judgment. Yeah. And you can't possibly say that didn't warrant a suspension.
I can't. And there's been many columns written about it, Michael, but I think that there's some point. Brendan Shanahan has been intending to at least give off the perception that he's hard-nosed. But this was a gaffe. I don't think there's any other way to slice it.
You know, it was a gaffe. I think that both teams recognized it. But do you think that Shanahan didn't give the suspension knowing that, okay, well, he'll just end up having to fight in the next game?
Even so. I mean, if he had given the suspension, it would have been a suspension and then the fight anyways.
That's true. And, you know, going back to rules for different style players, Byron Bitts lays the hit on Kyle Clifford, who's, you know, a third, fourth line guy for LA.
What if it's Crosby?
What if it's Henrik Sedin? Yeah. What if it's some better player? Do you think he gets more games?
It's a great question. What if Duncan Keith, I mean, obviously Daniel Sedin's still feeling the effects. What if Duncan Keith hits Byron Bitts on that hit? Is it one game or is it 2 games? Well, I don't think there's a uniform rule across the board. I think that's unfortunate because safety should not be dictated by the letters on the back of a jersey. They should be dictated by the action.
And Richie, isn't this almost perpetuating a problem that we've been talking about in the 3 or so years that we've been doing the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, talking about suspensions, headshots, hits from behind? When this happens in the playoffs, and it is important, And I want to, you know, repeat myself. I'm a huge Shea Weber fan, and I think he's a tremendous defenseman. But it's principle here.
One action does not a career make, is he?
No.
But it's still an action.
And it's principle. Now Shea Weber, yeah, sure, you know, he dropped the gloves with Todd Bertuzzi, and they settled it like men, and that's fine. But now you haven't been reprimanded. You haven't missed any time. Your team hasn't been penalized. Right. $2,500 is nothing. You might as well fine him, like you said, a loony. Throw a loony into the jar. It's nothing. Now you haven't sent a message. You haven't set the tone for the rest of the playoffs.
We don't know if Bertuzzi would have fought Weber if Weber had been suspended, but I thought there was a telling statement by Mike Babcock after last night's game when he said, we felt that was not a hockey play. And if there was no action by essentially saying that if there's no action by the National Hockey League about this play, then we are going to take actions into our own hands.
And guys, it is serious because I'll be honest. At first, I kind of thought, okay, yeah, he might get suspended. And then of course, you know, we'll see it replayed on TSN and CBC, and we'll talk about it on the radio. And then you watch it, and it was a little bit bizarre in the sense that usually you'll give a guy a shot or push him, but
yeah.
Weber took his head and rammed it into the glass. And it is serious.
I had personally never seen it.
Right. And the thing is, you don't joke around about this stuff. And when you look at Daniel Sedin, who is now not going to play in the first round, and it's possible we're not going to see him again in the playoffs with the effects of post-concussion syndrome, and you know Duncan Keith got suspended 5 games, now you have to think, okay, well, Duncan Keith was suspended 5 games. That's significant. Could they have suspended him more? Is this really going to – what are they trying to do here? Are they just trying to really give the maximum that they can possibly?
My biggest issue with all these concussions, and you know, it's like Aaron Rome gets all those games, and all people complain about is Aaron Rome in those games. Well, that hit on Nathan Horton – Nathan Horton was re-injured this year, but that hit clearly played a factor in the injury that Nathan Horton incurred this year, right? And Sedin has been missing more than 5 games. And you're not going to do a matching penalty, meaning like the player stays out for as long as the injured player, because then they can hold out injured players. There's too many issues with that. But I think we have to stop talking about these suspensions in 3 to 5 game, 3 to 5 game parts. Instead, focus on the fact that a concussion is a serious injury, can keep you out for a prolonged period of time. See Sidney Crosby, see Daniel Sedin, see David Booth. It's an endless list, and that's scary. But why is a head hit not generating suspensions of 15 to 20 games? That's what I want to know. And I don't know if we're going to get an answer to that. But and maybe it's the precedents that have been set. You can set new precedents.
And on that topic, guys, I realize that Byron Bitt's got 2 games. That could have easily got 10 games.
Exactly.
If you're trying to set
exactly
Byron Bitt's, I mean, you know what? I love the grinders in hockey. You know that I love the guys like the GST line, and I love the guys that lay body checks. But his hit had absolutely nothing to do with the play, and he could have broken his neck, and you give him 2 games.
That's true. And I hate the hits from behind. I hate the head hits. These are plays, you know, they say they're not hockey plays. They aren't hockey plays. And if you keep allowing them, if you keep allowing them and you don't suspend them and you fine Shea Weber $2,500 for a guy that makes millions and millions of dollars,
nothing will change.
Nothing will change. He will not remember that 5 minutes later. And that's the unfortunate part. After the break, we're going to talk about the Calgary Flames. There's a coaching change this week. Brent Sutter's out. What does that mean for Brent Sutter? What does that mean for the franchise? You're listening to the Legal Curve Hockey Show, live on TSN 1290.